Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Health and Human Service Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has canceled close to $500 million in research funding for mRNA vaccines, the same technology that was used for COVID-19 vaccines. He said the mRNA technology is ineffective, unsafe, and unethical. But when thinking about vaccines developed during the pandemic, mRNA technology is thought to have saved millions of lives. And vaccines for other upper respiratory infections like COVID and the flu are in development. Health officials and researchers and many others are concerned. Joining us now is David Lim, reporter for Politico, whose focus is on the FDA and pharmaceutical policy. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've been following vaccine policy and RFK Jr.'s statements on the health in America for a while now. What was your reaction when you heard the decision to cancel almost $500 million specifically in mRNA research funding?
You know, that's a great question. I think in some ways it was unsurprising because the administration had already moved to pull back funding from mRNA efforts by Moderna. In previous months, but certainly this has caught the eye of experts who worry that this could leave us on the back foot when responding to future pandemic threats.
Now, do you know if he cut all research funding for all types of vaccines, or this was just specific to mRNA?
This was specific towards the mRNA platform, and there has been some debate over whether or not all the $500 million in question was specifically on mRNA, or if the administration also incidentally canceled some research that was focused on other efforts.
Yeah, because I would think that some vaccine research labs probably do both. They research all different types of vaccines, right? So the funding might be fluid.
Yeah, I can't say with certainty, but that's something I'm keeping an eye on in the future.
Yeah. So what have you heard from health officials? What was their immediate reaction at the thought of less money to research mRNA?
Right. So overwhelmingly, people, both Republicans and Democrats, expressed concern about this decision. I spoke to Rick Bright, who led HHS's medical investment arm, about the decision. He led investments for the government in the years before COVID and into COVID before criticizing the Trump administration's early COVID-19 response. He called it a huge strategic misstep, and he said that it signals a dangerous complacency because mRNA, in his view, is one of the fastest tools to develop a vaccine that can respond to the next pandemic, whether it's natural or a deliberate biochemical or bio-developed virus.
Yeah, the mRNA vaccine research is new. Is that a part of the issue for RFK Jr. and people who support him? They're basically saying that this technology hasn't been tested enough. He feels like other vaccines that have been around longer are better?
That's a good question. So advocates for the platform for mRNA vaccines have repeatedly said that this has been a technology that has been under development for years, if not decades. And that's part of the reason that we're able to deploy it during COVID-19 to great effect. But you're right, RFK Jr. has historically been a skeptic of mRNA vaccines in particular. He has criticized their safety before becoming HHS secretary. And it's interesting, the administration, so his NIH director, Jay Bhattacharya, has said that it's a matter of public trust in the actual mRNA vaccines. There's a little bit of a split within senior officials in the administration between Kennedy, who has moved to cancel these contracts, and his NIH director, who is really focusing on whether or not mRNA vaccines were they to be developed in the future, if the public would be willing to take them in a manner that would have great effect for containing any future threat.
Later in the hour, we're going to be talking with a vaccinologist who actually helps develop vaccines, and he's going to explain to us the difference between mRNA and other ones and talk about the research. So I don't expect you to be a vaccinologist or anything, but the idea that mRNA vaccines have been around for years, but we only recently heard of them because of COVID. So is the tie to COVID maybe a part of the problem when it comes to RFK Jr. and the people surrounding him? They're anti-mRNA because they were anti a lot of COVID policies.
I think that one of the big frustrations that some of the RFK camp ha is with how public health officials during the pandemic conveyed the benefit and the risk of the mRNA vaccines. Specifically, I hear a lot in conversations with interviewees and sources frustration around the CDC's communication about whether or not you could get COVID-19 again, were you to take a COVID vaccine, and whether or not once you take it, if you would be able to spread the virus to other people. And I think that that is one thing that public health, broadly speaking, has acknowledged that communication when the COVID vaccine rolled out, the risk and benefits could have been communicated a little bit better. But what experts that I speak to say unequivocally is that the COVID-19 vaccine, especially for older Americans who are more vulnerable to COVID-19, was very valuable when it came to avoiding hospitalizations and deaths from the virus. I know at the top of the call you mentioned how people think that millions of lives were saved because of this product. And I think that's something to contextualize the frustrations with public trust about how the vaccine was rolled out.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about recent defunding of mRNA vaccine research with Politico reporter David Lim. Now, just one day before RFK Jr.'s announcement about the money, President Donald Trump was reflecting on COVID and mRNA vaccines, and he called the distribution of the vaccines one of the most incredible things ever done in this country. So, does President Trump agree with Kennedy's decision here?
I think that's a good question. I am curious what the president's understanding of the decision making is here. Obviously, the president has expressed great pride in the Operation Warp Speed, which was the development of the COVID-19 vaccine during the COVID-19 pandemic. Obviously, President Trump was president at the time, and a lot of people say that his willingness to put a lot of money into vaccine development was one of the reasons that we were able to get a vaccine that was effective so quickly. If you remember, during the early stages of the pandemic, people thought that it might take possibly years to develop a vaccine that would be capable of returning society to kind of the daily life that we know and expect.
There is some reporting out there that President Trump said he would speak to Kennedy about this decision about the mRNA money. Do you know if anything's come of that?
I haven't, but I am keeping a close eye on that.
What are you hearing about the long-term effects of this decision? Because I don't know if $500 million is a lot of money for vaccine research. We're going to ask our next guest, what other countries are doing and that kind of thing when it comes to developing mRNA technology. But what's the long-term effect of not spending this particular money on mRNA research here in the United States?
Right. So one thing to keep in mind is that the federal government is the originator of a lot of medical research through the NIH and other efforts, similar to kind of what we're talking about with these mRNA vaccine research contracts. But one of the big effects that I've heard people worried about is the effect that it will have on private investment in vaccines, both mRNA and other traditional platforms. There's a concern that some of the decision making at the top of HHS might make it less feasible for a company to say, you know what, we're going to develop a vaccine for this condition because there is concern about adoption and the support from the regulatory structures that the government has.
Yeah, that's an interesting point too with private money, because it's not just federal research, like people who work for the government who are researching vaccines. I mean, people work for the private sector. There's all kinds of companies with a lot of money in vaccine research, but then also in the making and distribution of vaccines. So there has to be private money out there too. Or have you heard anything about companies, like the Modernas and the Pfizers and Johnson and Johnson, about them continuing to work with mRNA?
It's something that I'm keeping a close eye on, earnings calls and what their leaders and CEOs are saying in public. Obviously, there's a lot of other considerations that they have at the moment. The Trump administration is pressing them to lower the price of their medications in the U.S., threatening to take regulatory action to force them to match prices offered in other countries. So we're seeing, a variety of incentives for these company executives when it comes to their discussions in public.
Do you know if anything has changed so far? I mean, RFK Jr. making an announcement rescinding mRNA research money. Does that mean research is halted the next day, or is this a long-term thing?
I think that it's certainly not an immediate impact, but it will have an impact in the medium to long term, according to people that I speak to.
The mRNA vaccines are out there right now. I mean, I know there's
That's right.
there's differing recommendations. We'll talk about COVID vaccines specifically. So there's differing recommendations out there for whether to get COVID vaccines this coming fall. Get your COVID shot and your flu shot at the same time, all those campaigns we had for the last 2 years. But so people can get an MR, whether they follow the recommendations or not, there's an mRNA vaccine that you can go to CVS or Walgreens and get a mRNA COVID vaccine right now. They're there, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So it doesn't, I guess the money just halts future research. Is that, or what happens next with mRNA? Is that your understanding?
So, I mean, certainly the contracts, the 500 million that we're talking about, that does impact research in the future. I think in terms of the availability of the COVID-19 vaccine, there are separate actions that RFK Jr. and the Trump administration are taking that could potentially impact the availability of COVID-19 vaccines for certain populations. You've seen effort to from the FDA to alter kind of the recommendations and the label for these shots, and in broad terms to make it so that people who have underlying risk or more vulnerability to COVID would still be able to get the shots, but in terms of young, healthy individuals, there may be questions in the coming COVID-19 season in terms of what the label and the recommendations will be for that population from the government.
And I'll talk with my next guest about this, but have you heard from researchers who are concerned about this loss of funding about what they were working on? Were there certain illnesses or things that they were hoping an mRNA vaccine would work for that was in the works?
Right. Yeah. So that's a great question. There are a few things that are under development that I think people had hopes for the mRNA vaccine platform for. Specifically, you mentioned flu vaccines. There's no approved mRNA shot for flu vaccines at the moment, but there are those products under development. You've seen clinical trials from Moderna and other companies in that space. And then also cancer vaccines. People have some hope that mRNA vaccines may be a tool that could be used to combat cancer through vaccination. So that's another area that people worry may face a slowdown in research due to this action.
We have been talking with David Lim, a reporter for Politico who focuses on the FDA and pharmaceutical policy. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a researcher who has worked to develop vaccines. That is When All Sides Continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Most people are not vaccinologists. They take whatever vaccines their doctor recommends, the flu shot, Tdap, shingles, COVID. So when the average person heard that Health and Human Services Secretary was planning to end research funding for mRNA vaccines, they may not know exactly what that means. Dr. Ted Ross is the Global Director of Vaccine Development at the Cleveland Clinic. His research is based out of Cleveland Clinic's Ted Ross Lab. And Dr. Ross has worked with the National Institutes of Health, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the World Health Organization. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Ross.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So in layman's terms, tell us, what is an mRNA vaccine as opposed to other vaccines?
So it's just a different platform in order to deliver the vaccine to the host to generate a stimulated immune response that will hopefully elicit memory and protect you when you see the pathogen in the future. MRAs differ from more traditional vaccines that we've known in the past because they incorporate genetic information that is making the proteins inside our bodies instead of purifying those proteins outside and then administering them to a needle or injection into our arm.
Which one of our vaccines utilizes mRNA technology? Is it just COVID, or are there other ones out there that people get that we might not know uses mRNA?
Currently in the United States, mRNA vaccines are approved for COVID vaccinations, which we all are aware of over the last 5 years. But the technology has been used now for a variety of different infectious disease and cancer-related diseases that have a lot of promise and a lot of ability to react quickly to emerging threats. So for example, in the influenza field, influenza vaccines are now being developed for mRNA. For tropical diseases such as dengue virus, which affects people in Central and South America primarily, these types of vaccine strategies are being used. And really one of the more exciting areas now is that for using antigens or neoantigens for cancers, particularly hard cancers that are difficult to have treatments for, like pancreatic and prostate and lung cancers. Those are now being shown a lot of promise with mRNA vaccines. And I think you'll see those move towards the clinic over the next several years.
How was mRNA discovered as opposed to just sticking with what we knew and what we knew how to make?
Well, without going to a long story, back in the 1990s, investigators were trying to come up with new ways to vaccinate against really chronic diseases. And the biggest one at that time was HIV. And how can you make a vaccine? The traditional ways of making those vaccines were not effective. So the one option was to take genetic material, whether it's DNA or RNA, and use it to vaccinate people and then have those genetic material make the vaccine inside the body. Those seemed very effective in animal studies. And therefore, the idea of taking these and moving them into a platform, such as a what we call a lipid nanoparticle, and administering them to a host, started moving forward for many years. And that's why we were prepared when the COVID pandemic came about, that these technologies had been tested many times and was well known at the time of the pandemic that started in 2020.
So the I guess I should know this from like a high school biology class, but the letters mRNA, tell me why it's called that.
Okay. So we're all familiar with DNA,
Yeah.
deoxyribonucleic acid, and that is the genes that make up our cells. But in order for one of those genes to generate a protein inside our body, it has to go through a translational step. And that's what the mRNA is. It stands for messenger ribonucleic acid. It translates the DNA into RNA, and then an RNA is translated into proteins that we utilize in our body to build cells, to deal with hormones, to make antibodies, to deal with all the things that our body needs to function. That's the mRNA. And so, in order to make it as a vaccine, we short-circuited. We take the material that would be a genetic material, let's say of the virus, and we turn it into an mRNA sequence. And we use that to do vaccination to produce those proteins inside our bodies.
Okay. What is the technology for other vaccines, ones that have been around longer? That's more the injecting the antibodies, right?
Yeah, so traditionally, the most widely used vaccines that have been really quite effective are known as live attenuated. That means you take the real pathogen, you modify it in a way so it doesn't cause severe disease or disease at all in a person, and we use it to vaccinate or infect the person, and it generates a robust immune response. Some of those vaccines, such as smallpox, measles, mumps, rubella, we all got those as kids. Those are all live attenuated viruses, meaning they're real viruses. It's just you don't feel sick when you get infected with those. Other types of vaccines are you take those viruses and you kill them, you chemically inactivate them, or you break them up into pieces. And so we've seen that used before. And that was really the traditional way since the 1930s of how we vaccinate people for the last 70 years. More recently, we've gotten into recombinant proteins, which are essentially synthetic proteins of the viral proteins. And so the hepatitis B vaccine is a recombinant protein, more modern vaccine, where you synthesize that protein in the culture dish, you purify it, and then we administer it to you instead of giving you the whole virus. And we had to move away a little bit from live attenuated viruses because some of them were, all the easy ones had been done. And the
All
ones that were left were the hard ones.
the easy ones. That's
And
funny.
it's very difficult, for example, I'll use HIV as an example, to give someone a live attenuated HIV virus. If that wasn't successful, then you just administered the real pathogen to somebody. So that's very difficult to test. So we needed to come up with new, more modern technologies that'd be able to address vaccination without putting people at risk and reduce the safety. And so mRNA, DNA, killed recombinant proteins are really the new wave. I mean, mostly talking about viruses because that's where most vaccines are effective, but we've also generated them for pneumococcus. That's a recombinant protein-based vaccine for strep pneumo. And now people get that routinely. Human papillomavirus is a recombinant protein technology that has been used to vaccinate now children so they don't come down with cervical cancer later in life. And so these are really effective new modern technologies, but the old technologies are still around.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about mRNA vaccines with the Cleveland Clinic's Global Director of Vaccine Development, Dr. Ted Ross. So, do you specifically work on mRNA vaccines, or other kinds, or does someone like you do everything, or are you working on mRNA?
So yes, we work on mRNA and we work on other platforms. There's viral vector platforms also that have been used, and we use recombinant proteins a lot. My research is mostly in infectious disease. I have over the years worked with tropical diseases, HIV, but primarily for the last 25 years, I've been in a respiratory vaccine development, primarily to come up with next generation influenza vaccines. And so in order to do that, you have to deal with a lot of different issues in that there's a lot you have to make a vaccine that works in all people. And right now, the flu vaccine, while it's effective a lot for young adults, it's not as effective for elderly, it's not effective for children, it's not effective for pregnant women. So we need new technologies to come along. And mRNA had promised for doing that. And so I think it's not going away, despite what our government is suggesting. There's going to be a lot of use for it in a lot of different fields beyond just infectious disease and cancer.
You joined the Cleveland Clinic in 2022. So that was you know, right in the midst of COVID-19 waning, but, you know, when everyone was talking about the vaccines left and right. What was your involvement in development of the COVID vaccine?
Well, we tend to do a lot of animal models in our laboratory. Mm-hmm. So we tested mRNA vaccines, dead versions of the virus vaccine. We tested those in our laboratory, and that data was made available to the manufacturers that they use for going to FDA for licensing.
Did you, I had your bio and I don't have it in front of me. Where did you work before the Cleveland Clinic?
So I was the director of vaccines and immunology at the University of Georgia for 10 years before I joined Cleveland Clinic. Partially that's because our laboratory started doing more human studies and I wanted to have access to hospital settings. And so that's why we moved to the Cleveland Clinic. We have been vaccinating people with current commercial vaccines for influenza, COVID, now RSV, to understand how people react to the current vaccines and sort of in order to compare how we are going to do with these new next generation vaccines. Mm-hmm. And so in order to do that, we have longitudinal studies of people who are enrolled in our studies to see how they react year after year as they age, as their health status changes, as different conditions in life, and as the vaccine gets updated. As you know, the flu vaccine gets updated annually. Mm-hmm. So we have now a long history of people's immunological information, their genetic information, their health status information as they age over time. We've been doing this now 15 years. And so we picked that up again at the Cleveland Clinic, and it gives us a large repertoire. So when we come with our more experimental vaccines, we have a baseline of knowing how people just react to vaccines in general.
Hmm. Was the COVID vaccine truly when mRNA was first used? I know you said the research had been going on since the 90s, but was that because that's when everyone started hearing these letters mRNA. So was it first with COVID?
It was. And it's because we were looking for technologies that were rapid, that could be flexible, and that could be generate a vaccine against this new pathogen very quickly. You know, traditionally, it takes 10 to 15 years to take a vaccine from the bench to the clinic to production. And so it was really unprecedented that we were able to move so quickly during the pandemic, because it was emergency use authorization to allow us to move these very quickly, do clinical trials, and get licensure for use in people. And that was really done to primarily reduce incidence of hospitalization and death. The mRNA vaccine has some issues, which people are aware of. It can cause some side effects, but that's not really different than any vaccine. Any vaccine will give you some side effects, but that doesn't mean it can't be improved. And so therefore, the technology is still around and people are still trying to improve it so that people don't have as bad reactions as they may have had when they first got the COVID vaccines.
Mm-hmm. There was one non-mRNA COVID vaccine. Right. How do you say it? Novavax. What were your insights on that one? It's been a while. I don't remember how effective it was. Yeah.
Well, it seemed pretty effective as well, but it came on later in the pandemic. And so not as many people got that vaccine as they did mRNAs, which were available in 2021, as soon as it came on the market. The only issue with the Novavax vaccine is that it uses a technology which makes what are called nanoparticles, and it's a little more expensive to make. The mRNA vaccine is also not cheap, and that's why having government subsidies at the time and during the pandemic was important to get it out to as many people as possible. But with the government not being able to support it any longer, it's going to be an issue up to our insurance to see whether or not people will be able to afford and continue to get vaccines of mRNA and COVID vaccines in general in the future.
You mentioned, you know, how quickly things went with using the mRNA vaccine, and that was to try to get us out of lockdown, get us out of the pandemic, have fewer people in the hospitals. So it was called Operation Warp Speed at the time. But as a vaccinologist, someone who had worked in vaccines for, I'm guessing, your entire career, that probably was unprecedented for you. Have you never worked so fast in your life?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny. I go back and think about that time as if it was some long time ago, and it was only just 5 years ago, but it was a completely different world. And we were all in a state of anxiety and trying to do as many things as one could as fast as possible. And bringing on the mRNA vaccines really began to reduce the incidence of disease and hospitalizations and death, which is what was really needed, Because if we didn't have a vaccine, if we took the traditional time, which might be a decade to get a vaccine in the market, we would have had many, many more people die from that pandemic than we did in 2020.
How adaptive are the COVID vaccines, the mRNA ones that are being developed for different strains of COVID over the years? Because, you know, everyone understands that there's a different flu shot every year. That's why you have to get it every year, because they're trying to predict which strain of flu is going to be the worst. But how is it going with the COVID strains?
So they keep getting updated each year. And that really hasn't changed, whether it's flu or COVID. Dealing with what is called the drift in the pathogen and the new variants that come up is still going to be a challenge. But the real advantage of mRNA vaccines and these type of technologies is that they're quick and adaptive. So you can bring in, if there's a new pandemic, let's say an H5N1 bird flu outbreak starts to transmit among people, it'll make it very easy to plug in that vaccine into the mRNA platform and start using it as quickly as possible. Whereas other vaccines may take time to get more development. That's essentially the issue with the Novavax vaccine, is it took a while to go through the process to get approval because it was a new technology that hadn't been utilized as much. And therefore the mRNA vaccine now is really a plug and play type of platform.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about mRNA vaccines with the Cleveland Clinic's Global Director of Vaccine Development, Dr. Ted Ross. And coming up, Dr. Ross is going to stay with us, and we're going to talk about what types of vaccines will be focused on if we are not funding more or new research for mRNA. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Funding for mRNA vaccines is being cut. United States Secretary of Health and Human Services, RFK Jr., has decided to block approximately $500 million in funding research for mRNA vaccines. He claimed the mRNA vaccines are ineffective, unsafe, and unethical. But are his claims really true? Still with us is the Cleveland Clinic's Global Director of Vaccine Development, Dr. Ted Ross, and he's been giving us a crash course here in vaccines. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Ross.
Thank you.
So I understand that you don't want to focus on anything political. You're a researcher, you're a scientist, but in this conversation, but you're teaching us about the scientific aspects of mRNA vaccines, and I appreciate you explaining it to all of us. But I have to ask what you thought when you heard about the federal funding cuts for mRNA research. What was your initial reaction?
Well, my reaction is that it's unfortunate. I don't think we should be cutting all the money for mRNA vaccines or really other vaccines in general. Right now, it's a reduction in the amount of money for mRNA vaccines from the government through NIH or through BARDA, but it's not completely zero. So there's still mechanisms that can be used to generate new research activities associated with mRNA vaccines. Most of the funding for the $500 million you refer to was through the BARDA program.
What is BARDA?
But NIH right now, there's still money available for that. That may be reduced in future budget appropriations, but we'll have to see. What that does is lead us down other paths to generate vaccines using other platforms, at least with government money. I don't think it's going to stop mRNA vaccine development. Many of the big pharmaceuticals have lots of investments in the technology. And it's also a worldwide, vaccines are not just United States, they're worldwide. So there's lots of companies that are still going to continue moving mRNA vaccines forward for various reasons.
Yeah, let me ask you about the funding aspect, because I said, you know, federal funding was reduced by about $500 million, but I don't know how much money it takes to make a vaccine. I don't know how much money is involved in this. I have to imagine there's private money out there. Does your lab, do you have private funding and federal funding?
We have federal funding. We have private funding, philanthropy. we also have internal money that comes from Cleveland Clinic itself. Mm-hmm. The real issue is that to move a vaccine forward, it takes many years, and you do all your testing in the lab, and you do all the work to show that it works. You get FDA approval. You can do what's called a phase 1 small pilot study in humans. And that's usually where the NIH takes the funding to. Then the real money kicks in. While that seems like a lot of money, it might be millions of dollars, to do what's called a field trial, a worldwide field trial, is hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's where BARDA comes in and other institutions like that come in to help put those vaccines forward to really determine the efficacy and the safety of them before they're started manufactured and distributed to the public in general. And so cutting BARDA funding and funding like that is going to be a bottleneck for moving vaccines forward beyond just the small level into the major level. Because if you don't do those phase 2 and 3 trials to really determine the safety, you can't move forward and get licensure, and you can't really get a worldwide. So whether it's going to come from the United States, whether it comes from the EU, that money would have to be made up somewhere to have those technologies such as mRNA move forward for other vaccines.
I understand the alphabet soup of all of this. I understand most of it, NIH, but BARDA, what is BARDA again? You don't have to tell me what it stands for, but what is it out of? Or give me a couple
of letters.
It's
under HHS. So yeah. It's under HHS. It's just the next level where most of the clinical trials are supported on technologies that have been. NIH does mostly preclinical and discovery. And once something has gone through that phase, it moves into more, we're going to make this into a product phase. And that's where BARDA comes in. And we're actually going to test that in people, determine that it doesn't cause disease and it doesn't have any bad side effects.
Now, I mentioned that RFK Jr. called the vaccines ineffective, unsafe, and unethical. So I wanted to lean into the unethical word there. Why are people, not just him, but why are people calling mRNA unethical?
That I don't know. And I don't mean to be flippant, but it's just like, I don't know what makes it unethical. I haven't heard an explanation for why it would be unethical. What I can make an assumption is that it is that because it may have caused side effects, therefore we shouldn't be putting things into people that cause side effects. But as you know, if you watched any commercial on TV about a drug, there's a whole list of things they say at the bottom of potential side effects for anything. So it's not that it's not real, and it's not that people didn't experience, but you can see that for any drug or pharmaceutical item, there's always going to be a portion of the population that has adverse events. Those need to be monitored, they have to be reported, and if it becomes severe enough, the FDA will withdraw it from the market. But in general, that's because we're all unique snowflakes, we all are going to have different reactions to different vaccines and drugs.
The specific reactions that are side effects, rather, for mRNA vaccines, I mean, I can think of, you know, when I got the COVID shot, my arm hurt more than with any other vaccine I ever had. Right. What other side effects were people most worried about?
Well, most people had either mild or no side effects. You're right. Mm-hmm. So they had a sore arm. They might have felt warm, like they got a slight fever, but it went away. But there were some people that had severe reactions, heart reactions, what's called brain fog. People had, you know, disorientation. And so there's a lot that we don't know about it. That's why we need to study it and a lot of people to see what those issues and how you can ameliorate those issues. And so there's not that they're not real, but we do need to understand that it is typical with many pharmaceuticals and drugs and vaccines that people are going to have adverse reactions.
And just because it's been over time, mRNA vaccines don't have as many side effects. So is that why someone like RFK Jr. may be okay with other types of vaccines if they don't have as many side effects? Does that make them safer in his
give
eyes?
Me an example. Yeah. Give me an example. Like the flu vaccine, there are people that have reactions every year to the flu shot. Mm-hmm. Now, it's generally most people don't notice it or they have mild reactions, but there are people and we can document them and we know every year people have it. That doesn't stop us from generating flu vaccines, because the greater good of protecting the population against influenza in society is out there. So we try and moderate, you know, we make sure that pregnant women, if they're going to have a reaction to the flu shot, we don't do it. If you have egg allergies. So we know about these and we have a lot longer history than we do with, let's say, COVID vaccines.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about mRNA vaccines and other types of vaccines with the Cleveland Clinic's Global Director of Vaccine Development, Dr. Ted Ross. So I've used your title several times, the Global Director of Vaccine Development. So global. What is used around the world when it comes to the most types of vaccines that other countries are using?
Well, the most common is, as I mentioned, the live attenuated vaccines. These are the ones that are most historical and have the easiest ability. But there are honestly a lot of people around the world, particularly in developing countries, don't get access to vaccines. And that's why having new technologies is more appropriate, because the biggest issue is what is called cold storage, being able to keep these vaccines in refrigeration. It's very difficult if you're going to tropical locations or poor places where you don't necessarily have the access. So having vaccines that are what are called shelf stable, meaning you can just put them in a FedEx package and ship them, is much more important. But most of the vaccines that are available to the world are live attenuated.
So whenever we talk about, you know, your title is global director, are the vaccines that each country have based country by country? Does the United States make vaccines for us and most of them stay here, and France makes them for France and Spain for Spain? Or how does that work for, like, are there vaccines manufactured and they go all over the world?
Yeah, most of the vaccine manufacturers are international, big international companies. Sanofi Pasteur is out of France, Pfizer's out of Germany, Seqirus is out of Australia, and they make vaccines for the world. Now, they have manufacturing plants all around the world. So, for example, the ones for flu shots in the United States are made in the United States, but they're not necessarily American companies, they're international companies. And so they make vaccines for the world. For a long time, there was not a lot of vaccine manufacturing occurring in the United States. It was just considered to be liability issues, profitability issues. But more recently, particularly in the last decade, there are now manufacturers in the United States, such as Moderna, which is out of Boston, that is making vaccines here in the United States again, and they're an American company.
You've been in this field for a long time. You've talked about studying vaccines for your career. Have you ever had a time when politics has seeped so much into vaccine development?
Short answer is no. I'm really somewhat surprised how vaccines have become controversial. When we look back on the history of infectious disease over the last, let's say, century, the two major advances for reducing incidence of disease in people has been antibiotics for bacterial infections and vaccines for primarily viral infections. And I think part of the issue is that we're living with the success of eliminating or reducing these viruses and infections in our society. You know, smallpox was eradicated in 1977, and that was due specifically to vaccination of people. And once everybody became vaccinated, the smallpox had nowhere to go and it died. And I think that's what we're having to think about, is how vaccines have really altered our perception of infectious disease and how bad these pathogens are. And now we think of the vaccines as being more controversial than the pathogen themselves.
And I know that the idea that some vaccines cause autism has been debunked over and over again, but that is a part of what has made this so political. Does that, in it being the global director of vaccine development and spending your career in this, does that frustrate you that people can't hear the debunking of this vaccine causes autism?
Well, I think people get their information from a lot of different sources, some more reliable than others. And you really do need to listen to people and listen to what they're saying and make sure they understand, you know, what their fears are and what they're worried about. And what I try and do is talk about what I do with my family and my friends and what I do for myself, and sort of lead by example and say, I take vaccines for these reasons. I don't usually want people to believe misinformation. So I try and say that autism connection with vaccines have been debunked many times. But, you know, you really need to listen to people and make sure they understand that you are there, that you're not trying to lecture them, you're not trying to scold them, that the goal is, I understand your fears and let's figure out how we can ameliorate those fears for you.
Yeah. Do you have people telling you that they're afraid that their child's going to get autism because of the vaccines? Do you still have people telling you that?
Yes. a lot of reason they want to change the vaccine childhood regimen because they have read something, and, you know, there's a little skepticism about S-Burks these days, and they don't want to they think you're somehow trying to sell them something that, and the real goal is that there's a lot of people that have studied this. They've come up with the best consensus, and this is the information we're providing you, and we say this is the best way to go. But in the end, it's up to you to decide.
I feel like we're, and I don't know if you'll agree, but we might be turning a corner here where it's, it, I can't remember a time, and you're more into this than me, but the idea that who is in the White House can dictate vaccine usage. Do you, I can't remember a time, or I, what do you think of that? Is that
Well, the system has always been set up where we bring people in who are knowledgeable. Usually there's boards like the Vaccine Advisory Board at the CDC, and it's made up of people who've been doing this for a long time and a lifetime. Now we're bringing in political appointees to sit on these and have other people that already have a pre point of view that matches what the current administration is, feels. And therefore, I think it's going to undermine trust in people's ability to listen to these panels if they think you're just trying to find people that already agree with you. You need people that have different points of view, and sometimes they're going to disagree with you.
There are varying recommendations coming up just this year when it comes to the COVID boosters. Are you recommending, as someone who studies vaccines, are you recommending still getting the COVID booster? Even though you mentioned that earlier that we're not sure about insurance companies covering it, but
Right.
are you recommending it?
Yeah, from the science point of view, yes, I recommend it. I especially recommend it for people who are older. So what we've noticed about the COVID vaccines is that the immunity that you get begins to wane in about 6 months after being vaccinated. So similar to flu shots, I think we're going to almost have to have a booster on a regular basis in order to keep people's immunity up. The thing that's unfortunate about the COVID vaccine, but it's also similar to the flu vaccine, is that even if you're vaccinated, it prevents you from getting severely ill, but it doesn't tend to prevent transmission. So people can still spread the virus around. And that's the concern, is how can we come with a better vaccine to stop that, to break those chains of transmission. But to protect you and to protect your family, getting a booster shot is recommended.
Is that something you're working on, the future of COVID vaccines to break that chain?
Yes.
Yes.
You know,
Okay.
we have animal models that we can use to show that we're preventing them from spreading the virus when they're all in the same cage. One gets infected, the others, if you vaccinate them, prevent them from getting infected.
Okay. So that's in the works. And one thing before we run out of time, I did want to talk about what other illnesses you're working with mRNA. To like what else is in the works? We had a reporter on earlier in the show, and he was talking about using mRNA for the flu and for cancer
Yes.
vaccines. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're doing flu for sure. Without getting into the details of it, we are designing new vaccine candidates using AI. And by doing that, these new candidates will be able to hopefully deal with the drift associated with COVID and flu, and so that you don't have to get an annual shot every year. But using a platform that's easily being able to put it in, to pop it in, like mRNA, is one thing that we're using.
All right, so that's for the flu. And then what types of cancer vaccines have you or your clinic been researching?
Quite a few: lung, prostate, pancreatic. Those are three that we have almost really no treatments for, particularly for severe cancers. And so having a vaccine that will utilize that and stop the spread or reduce the disease is really what's the goal.
And pardon my ignorance, but the I know HPV is a proven vaccine, is a vaccine for preventing cervical cancer. Are there any other vaccines for cancers?
Not I don't think so.
Not off the top of your head. Okay. So I guess in the last 2 minutes we have left, the mRNA technology, you said that the research will continue, especially because it takes years in order to develop this, unless you're in the middle of Operation Warp Speed. So the idea of continuing the research despite the loss of federal funding, you does it do you, will it slow it down, or is it going to continue at the same pace?
I think it'll slow it down in the short term. But as you know, different administrations come in with different priorities, Congresses change over, and therefore I expect funding to continue for this and all sorts of vaccine development.
The idea that things change year to year. Do you worry about, I mean, $500 million, that's probably a drop in the bucket when it comes to the big picture of money over decades of developing a vaccine. So do you worry about any smaller labs closing or anything like that? Or is there there's enough money to keep things open and running, just maybe at a different pace?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing we've been dealing with for the past year has been the uncertainty factor. So having to plan for the future is difficult when you don't know what the future is, not steady and not secure. And so a lot of things got put on hold or paused for a few months to half a year because we weren't sure what the future is going to be. I think that's the, unfortunately, the negative effect about having this kind of funding pause or funding change is that people are going to just slow things down. And therefore, we're losing time. We're not being able to move things forward as quickly as we would in a normal situation.
We've been talking about mRNA vaccines with Cleveland Clinic's Global Director of Vaccine Development, Dr. Ted Ross. Dr. Ross, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I enjoyed talking to you.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to thank our producers, Senior Producer Marcus Charleston, Producer Aaron Esmont-Rubinowitz, Student Producer Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Kira Burson. Thanks to Iza Huck, who produced this show today. We also have Board Operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard, and Video Production by The Ohio Channel. If you missed any part of today's show, listen back at our website or subscribe to our podcast. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.